Welcome, welcome, welcome to yet another edition of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Regent. I'm your host for tonight, Diamond. Today we are going to talk about what it means to be a global citizen in the world. Now that our world is accelerated, where a decade ago we couldn't even think about seeing each other over the phone, now we can always FaceTime. How do we build an identity in the world and become global citizens? Today we have with us Kevin McGregor, a partner with the organization Collective Future that looks to create young programming for organizations that empower youth. He has a wealth of knowledge and experience with traveling and helping kids in different ways, teaching them to heal through play and build resilience. We will talk about what all that meant with him today. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming. So a lot of the work you do involves helping kids who are experiencing challenging health issues. Why did you want to help kids in that space?
I think it's a really good question, and it's a question that I get a lot. Why do I do what I do? And I don't have a very clear moment in my mind of when I decided that I wanted to go down this path. In high school, I got involved with some social justice initiatives and learned a little bit more about world issues. And I think at that point, just seeing youth that were my age going through really difficult things in other parts of the world and here in Canada, it just didn't make sense. So that sparked something. I had the chance to pursue that, and I studied international development for my undergraduate degree. And through that, I learned about what the whole global system is when we talk about aid and charities, and it's and there's a whole history of it. But then once I finished that, I jumped into an internship with a youth and child focused organization, and I just haven't left. I think I'm so incredibly lucky to be able to work with kids and youth. I think that we talk about things like health issues and inequalities that come along with that, and that's challenging. But I think if you ever work with youth, or if you are a youth yourself, you just see the energy that radiates, and there's a lot of hope and there's a lot of opportunity to prepare them to face these challenges. So that's kind of why I do what I do. And I love it.
So your profile says one of your passion projects is resilience building for children and young people, recovery and prosperity following childhood adversity and trauma. So what are the ways in which you feel or found effective to help you build resiliency following adversity and trauma?
It's a big question, but it's a good question. It really is. I think that first we got to start with the understanding of what resilience is, and it's become this almost buzzword, and it's used in a lot of different ways, and that's good. I mean, we're talking about it. We're talking about at the core of it, resilience is how are people responding to trauma, adversity, and the resilience aspect is that they're doing well after that trauma or adversity, and that's debated. What does it mean to be doing well following trauma? And the other thing about that is that everyone responds to trauma differently or adversity differently, and we have to take that into account. You and I could experience one exact same incident, and you'll come away from it feeling certain things, and I'll come away from it feeling potentially the complete opposite of that one experience. But resilience building, I think, when we talk about the ways that we found are most effective, the first thing to understand is that resilience isn't a quality, or it's not a trait that you have or you don't. You're not, Diamond, you're not resilient, or you're not resilient, and I'm not resilient or not resilient. We all have qualities and aspects to us, and it's a process. It's kind of a flow, and it also changes throughout our lives depending on our circumstance. So when we look at it from that perspective, the ways that are most effective for promoting resilience or helping kids, young people go through trauma and adversity is the individual themselves, helping them with some skills, some coping mechanisms, but it's also the spheres around them. And I'm a very visual person. So So if you picture like a kid right in the middle and then almost like radio waves coming out, then we have probably the closest radio wave to them would be their family. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe their siblings, their aunties, the people that are surrounding them, their caregivers. And then you have their school environments.
Yeah.
And then further out, you have like media, society, mm-hmm. and all of these have influences on the kid and the way that they interact with their world. And so the ways that are most effective for promoting resilience is when you're looking at all that, looking mm-hmm. at all these radio waves that are affecting affecting a child, but also all these radio waves that are supporting a child to go through a really traumatic incident.
Mm-hmm. So you actually have a podcast coming up in May called Growing Up Resilient. What's the content of that show and what themes are you going to explore?
I think exactly that. I think these topics of resilience, I get really excited about resilience mm-hmm. because it flips it. It flips the perception of trauma on its head. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking at it in terms of this very traumatic incident, some examples of traumatic incidences could be abuse or neglect. Mm-hmm. It could be maybe there's a car accident. You're in a car accident. You witness violence in your home or, mm-hmm. or on the street. These are very traumatic incidents. And I guess historically we were looking at it in terms of how is this had a negative impact on your life and how are we going to fix you? Mm-hmm. Whereas resilience flips that around to say, this happened and this is unfortunate that it happened, but what are the strengths that you have to make it through, mm-hmm. to make it through and still feel okay with yourself, okay with your relationships with others? So that's what the podcast is going to be about. It's going to be about sharing perspectives. It's going to be about sharing stories about resilience, mm-hmm. the various perspectives. We're going to have psychologists, psychiatrists talking about it from more of the clinical standpoint. Mm-hmm. We're going to have parents because I think when you talk about resilience and you talk about working with children and youth, it's very different when you're going case by case basis or mm-hmm. you're at a program versus a parent who's there every day or a caregiver that's there every day. So it's just going to be sharing these ideas about resilience and really trying to equip the listeners, whether mm-hmm. that's educators, mental health workers, youth themselves, mm-hmm. with the tools that they need to understand resilience and be able to promote it within themselves or others.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of resiliency, you are a Safe Talk facilitator and trained in applied suicide intervention skills, which is ASSIST for short. Suicide is a really sad issue for us to deal with, but it's part of life. How do you help with youth facing thoughts of suicide, and what advice, given your background, would you have for youth that are facing these tough times?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think having thoughts of suicide is certainly a very, very difficult thing to go through, almost mm-hmm. unimaginable, completely overwhelming for the individual that's going through that process. But it's also very important that we keep talking about it because if it's not talked about, it becomes stigmatized and people that are having those thoughts of suicide aren't able to reach out or don't feel comfortable. And mm-hmm. the conversation is growing in Canada. I see that with the mental health movements, Bell Let's Talk, these sort of things, which is really good that it's allowing some people that maybe wouldn't have reached out to reach out. Mm-hmm. And I did want to mention, because if there are any listeners that are having thoughts of suicide, there is support out there. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that you can reach out, there's the crisis distress center, and that's their phone number. You can call, or I'll say another option, but you can call 408-HELP. So that's 416-408-4357. Or they also have online chats and texting mm-hmm. available, which might be depending on the youth or the young person or even an adult. If they feel more comfortable with that, then they can text 741-741, and then they'll be able to engage in a chat with somebody out there that's looking to support them. Mm-hmm. So there's that immediate response. I think the other part of suicide and response is if your friend, you've noticed that their behaviors have changed, you have a gut instinct. We mm-hmm. all have gut instincts. And if you feel that something's not right, I think the thing that transformed my approach to suicide early on was to ask the question and to be empowered to ask the question. Mm-hmm. And you're going to really have knots in your stomach when you ask. You're going to think you're doing it completely wrong. You're mm-hmm. going to it's going to be uncomfortable. But I think that that's one of the main things is to, if you feel that, then ask that question. Mm-hmm. And I've gone through that process with a number of individuals. And the, for the people that did say yes, we got them the help that they needed. And yeah, so that's one thing. And then the last part is just, I think that there might be listeners out there. Suicide has affected so many of us mm-hmm. in Canada. And whether it was a friend, somebody that you knew at your school, or and that can be a really challenging thing. And if there's people out there that are having trouble with dealing with those, having known someone that died by suicide, reach out, because I think that that's if you the more you talk about it, the more you're able to understand, how to deal with those emotions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a lot of your background work involves helping kids that face real-life threatening medical issues from different professional fields. So based on experience, what do you think helps ease kids and make them recover faster when they have to deal with tough medical concerns at such a young age?
Yeah, I think just to give context, so I've worked with kids in hospital setting. Mm-hmm. So those are kids that have either chronic illnesses or maybe they were in a car crash themselves and mm-hmm. had some type of surgery. I've also worked with kids in refugee camps. I've worked with kids that are living in pretty high levels of poverty, worked with in indigenous communities in the north. Mm-hmm. And in all of those settings, there's been challenges with health challenges, kids that need access or that are facing these life-threatening conditions. And I think I'm going to quote a song that it's a little bit older, but hopefully you'll know. But that song about girls just want to have fun.
Okay.
That's not too bad today. Good. I think kids just want to have fun. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a universal truth that I've found, that despite the context, people will often say, I can't imagine working with kids that are facing, that are terminally ill or that are living in a refugee camp, that are facing these health challenges, if you will. But kids do just want to have fun, and, mm-hmm. and also the strength and the courage and the resiliency of these kids is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. You see that they are going through significant amounts of pain, depending on the situation, but there is a universal truth to kids' ability to be kids,
yeah.
to smile, to have fun. If I think about in the hospital, for example, we just switch it. Instead of a game where we're moving around and playing with the ball, we might play something where they're in their bed because they mm-hmm. have to stay in their bed, but they still want to play. They still want to engage their creativity, and they still want to have silly little jokes and all mm-hmm. this kind of stuff. So it's actually a privilege to work with kids in every context. And I think, kids that are facing these serious life-threatening conditions are no different than kids that are mm-hmm. that are not.
Yeah. So you also work with Right to Play, an organization that uses sports and play to educate and empower children to overcome poverty, conflict, and disease. Based on your work experience, how do you think kids overcome these challenges through just playing? Can it be that simple?
I love the almost suspiciousness there. Wait a minute. Can you really do that through play? I would say yes. I think that play is transformative. And I'm not saying that that is everything. I think that there's a lot that goes into when we talk about poverty, conflict, disease. Mm-hmm. These are very big things. But I'll tell you at the end why I think that through play we can actually do that. But play itself, and I can't speak on behalf of Right to Play, I should say that mm-hmm. right now. play does have this capacity to influence a lot of things. So through play, you can learn soft skills, mm-hmm. like having self-confidence, self-efficacy, which is kind of, or internal locus of control, you feeling like you're in control of your actions, mm-hmm. Having a positive self-image. And you do that through your interactions with others. It also has things like, has positive benefits, like positive peer-to-peer interactions. In most games, there's different types of games, actually. There's solo play. Mm-hmm. There's play that you might do on a digital device. But in most of those interactive games, you have to negotiate the social relationship. So if I'm playing a game with you, I can't just bombard you with the rules and, mm-hmm. okay, Diamond, now we're going to do this, and
yeah.
Diamond, do this, because then you're going to be like, no, I'm not going to play with you. I'm going to go play over there.
Yeah.
So it's also about building those social relationships, positive social relationships, mm-hmm. and also learning to deal with conflict, because in games, usually, or I don't know, it depends on the game you're playing, but there could be a level of competition.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come up with that, come up to that competition or conflict, you have to negotiate that. Mm-hmm. And it's a really cool space for kids to learn about their roles within societies in a safe space. So when you're playing, there's not the rules that maybe they have in the classroom. Mm-hmm. It can be silly, but maybe they saw a behavior that their parent did, mm-hmm. and subconsciously they were wondering about that action. So then they bring it up when they're playing house or something, and then just see how did that play out in this situation. So it can be and it's fun, and it's meant to be fun, and mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also, I mean, if you are interested in that kind of stuff, there's science on the neurological benefits of play, mm-hmm. and how that relates, especially young kids as they're growing up. Their brain is developing. They mm-hmm. need different types of stimulation, and play is an excellent way for parents to interact with their kids. Mm-hmm. Play is awesome. And then I said that I'd say it at the end. So I do also think that as we build these skills, as I mentioned, the soft skills and also these positive peer-to-peer relationships, creativity mm-hmm. within those kids, I think that that also equips them to be able to tackle some of the very, very challenging issues of poverty, of conflict, mm-hmm. of disease, and other things as well, because they're thinking outside the box when you're playing. If you've ever played with Lego, then you probably didn't build the exact same thing every single time. Like, there is an element of creativity. And I think that when we talk about these big, so even social injustices, racism, these things need creative and out-of-the-box solutions, because mm-hmm. obviously what we're doing right now is not working. Mm-hmm. So I think also that we're equipping the next generation through play to mm-hmm. do some serious work.
Yeah. So the current organization you work for, Collective Future, is a consulting agency that helps organizing develop effective programs to help build the community-based organizations. You supported Right to Play with our operational launch of a four-year project that focuses on increasing participation mm-hmm. and the life skills for refugee and migrant children and youth in Thailand. What went into creating this project?
A lot. and maybe I'll just explain what operational launch mm-hmm. means, because it's also it's that there was a vision for, and there was a need. Mm-hmm. Particularly, we were working in the refugee camps, and there were certain things that came to life, including an elevated number of suicides mm-hmm. that were occurring. And we just saw that there was a need for something, and more access to something for the youth. Mm-hmm. And so we started talking to youth groups. We started talking to community leadership. And with that, we put a proposal together, which went to, actually, you probably know them. You know IKEA?
Yeah.
IKEA Furniture. So shout out to them. They have a foundation, which is mm-hmm. separate from the company. Like, you can't go into an IKEA and I don't know, do humanitarian programs, mm-hmm. but they have a separate foundation that manages that. And they supported us. So we submitted this proposal. We said, we have this vision. And so the operational launch is after they've said, yes, we also agree that this is a need, that this is a good vision. And the operational launch is going back to the communities, because some time passes in between, saying, okay, we've got the resources to do this. How do we want to do this? How do we mm-hmm. want to roll this out? So a lot goes into that. One of the most exciting things about this project that was, for me, really nice, was that it was youth-driven and youth-led. Mm-hmm. So those perspectives that we were getting were from the youth and from children as well, actually, mm-hmm. through games. We were trying to gain, where in the community do you feel safe? Where do you want to feel safe? Like, what do you want to be doing? Yeah. And having the youth drive it through youth councils. There's this ladder of youth participation. It's Roger Hart's ladder of participation. Mm-hmm. And we use that. So they're at the bottom. It's not good. It's where youth are being manipulated. Mm-hmm. Or if you move up, they're being used as a token mm-hmm. within councils, so that they're like, oh no, we talked to the youth, look, here's Diamond, she's right here. But then if you go all the way to the top, then you actually have adults and youth making decisions together. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what our goal was, to get to that point, but it's definitely not at that point right now. But mm-hmm. through this process, we were trying to consult with the youth, how do we want to do this project? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that we just had a bunch of really awesome staff that were all the frontline workers, they're facilitators, trainers, they're so passionate, and they were really awesome at engaging the youth and mm-hmm. Laying the groundwork for this project. And it's up and running right now. It's going really well. I'm still in contact with them. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
So what was your support system when you decided to take on these big projects? What resources did you tap into to make your project successful?
I think, so if I think of the personal level, I think of all of my studies have allowed me to understand this international development system. Mm-hmm. I think that probably some of the most important skills that I've had as a professional has been the ability to actually bring people together and have them share their voice. Mm-hmm. Because if I just go in there, I'm like, okay, this is what we're going to do. It's going to be awesome. You're going to love it.
Yeah.
And I'm not from that community. And mm-hmm. I don't know the context. I can read about it. I can live it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that ability to bring people together to elevate it, elevate their voices for what they see as the solution to these challenges. So there's those supports. The support that goes into that is I was one of the only expats or foreigners that were mm-hmm. that was there working on the project, and the majority were not only from the community, but they were within the camps. It's an ethnic group that came from Burma or mm-hmm. Myanmar, and they fled. So they're Karen, and so most of our staff were also Karen. So mm-hmm. it was people from the community working for the community, mm-hmm. and I think that's the only way that you can do it. I don't think that you can do it any other way because. So those are the main resources. I mean, then there was the financial resources to bring mm-hmm. it all together and those things. But to really get the work done, it was just leveraging the community's mm-hmm. The community's energy.
Yeah. So you mentioned you traveled to a lot of places like Burkina Faso, Bolivia, Ethiopia, and Uganda. What was your favorite place you traveled to? What stood out the most to you about this place and why?
I don't know. it's a really good question. I think, I'll go with Burkina Faso because mm-hmm. Burkina Faso was the first country that I lived in mm-hmm. Away from home. And I was there for a year. So mm-hmm. it was a while. It forced me to deal with culture shock. It forced me to deal with living with abject poverty, mm-hmm. and what is my role in that as an ally? It holds a place in my heart basically because it did change me so fundamentally. I would say Burkina Faso, but every place that I've been has been exceptional for just very different reasons. Mm-hmm. I think that the people that I met with in Bolivia were just so warm and kind, and they're all overgeneralizations because I only visited with the fraction of the people that live in this entire beautiful country with its culture and traditions. Mm-hmm. As an example of one of the beautiful traditions, people here drink a lot of coffee. Mm-hmm. In Ethiopia, they also drink a lot of coffee. Yeah. And beautiful, delicious coffee comes from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And one of the amazing things about traveling there was when every time I met with a community group or a group of moms, mm-hmm. They would always do the coffee ceremony to welcome us. And it's just getting to experience those beautiful moments of mm-hmm. sharing. And I've experienced that every single place I've been from overseas also to the beautiful indigenous communities in Northern Ontario that I've worked with.
So these places you travel to assist in youth programs predominantly focus on health and wellness. So what kind of programs and practices do you find most effective for kids across the board?
Yeah, I think this is also an interesting one because people always, they want a solution. They want, mm-hmm. okay, so what's the one thing that's going to work for every youth everywhere in the world? Mm-hmm. But I actually do think there is one solution, mm-hmm. and that's to put, and it's what I mentioned with what we were doing in Thailand, it's to put the power, the decision-making, everything in the hands of the youth mm-hmm. and in the hands of their support systems that are working within communities, so their allies, their parents, caregivers, their educators, their community leaders. Mm-hmm. I think that too often people are going into youth programming with expertise, and they know quote unquote what needs to be done, mm-hmm. and that's fine because they're building on what's worked in other contexts, and I think that's really important. Is to if something works really well in Regent Park, we should be sharing that with another community that's going through a similar challenge or that's just facing a similar context of how did the youth in Regent Park do something as awesome as this radio show, mm-hmm. for example. But with that, you still have to put that in the hands of the young people and mm-hmm. of their allies to develop what the approach to addressing these challenges is going to be. And I think that that's what I've seen. The most effective programs that I've ever seen with youth have been mm-hmm. when youth are driving it, where communities, organizations might come in and they might say, yeah, I'm Collective Future, so this is going to be the Collective Future project. Mm-hmm. The best project that I've seen, they actually ditched that. They're like, yeah. no, we're naming it this, and this yeah. is our project, and this is what we're going to do. And not in a disrespectful way, mm-hmm. but in a community ownership way, where mm-hmm. they were like, we actually want to name it based on they had a ceremony to actually name the program mm-hmm. based on their own culture. So anyway, all of that to say, the most effective things that I've seen are when youth and communities are actually driving what the youth programs mm-hmm. look like.
So we're running out of time for our show. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I just thank you for putting me at ease. My heart was pumping when I came in here. I was like, okay, I got Diamond though. She knows what she's doing. Okay. She's really good at this. She eased me. So no, thank you. And I think that what you guys do is fantastic. And yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So that's all the time we have for this portion of the show. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being in the studio with us today to talk about your work and helping kids around the world reach their fullest potential.